Here we go. Here we go. Let's go to page 60. Let's go to page 60. Right after the three pertinent ideas.
And it says, being convinced. Being convinced of what? The ABCs. Being convinced we were at step three, which is that we decided to turn our will and our life over to God as we understood Him. Just what do we mean by that, and just what do we do? Very important question. We're going to make a decision to do what? Turn our will and our life over to the care of God as we understood Him.
Again, if we don't understand the words the way the writer understood them, the information that comes through will be garbled and incomplete information. I think there's three words in step three that we really need to look at very carefully. And the first one is the word decision. I hear people in AA today, they say, I've been in AA for 4 years. My life's still all screwed up. And I don't know why, because I turned it over to God 2 years ago when I took step three. No, we don't turn anything over to God in step three. We make a decision to turn something over to God in step three. And the word decision itself implies that there's going to have to be some further action. And a good example in my own life, Barbara and I decided some time ago to go to Los Angeles, California and visit our relatives. But we didn't do anything to carry out that decision, and sure enough, we didn't get to California that year either. The next year, we made a decision to go to California. And again, we didn't do anything to carry it out, and by golly, we didn't get to California the second year either. The third year, we made the same decision, only this time it was a little different. I took the car down and had it serviced. Barbara packed the clothes and a little food. And we got in our car and we drove from our home to Tulsa, Oklahoma. Then we drove to Oklahoma City. Then we drove to Amarillo, Texas. Then we drove to Albuquerque, New Mexico. Then we drove to Flagstaff, Arizona. Then we drove to San Bernardino, California. Then we drove to Los Angeles. And by golly, one day we ended up in the living room of our relatives visiting with them. Not because we made a decision, but because we took the action necessary to carry out that decision. And I think we all need to be aware of the fact that in step three, all we're doing is making a decision. What is it we're deciding to do? We're making a decision to turn our will over to the care and direction of God as we understand Him. What is our will? And our will is nothing more than our thinking apparatus. Our will is nothing more than our mind. You know, tying together thinking with the word will. Let's say that some of us are beginning to approach the end of our lives, which a few of us in here are getting pretty close. We've gathered up a few material things and we become concerned with what's going to happen to them when we pass on. If we get concerned enough, we'll go sit down with an attorney. And I might say, I want this to go to my spouse, I want this to go to my son, I want this to go to my daughter, etc., etc., etc. That attorney will take my thinking as of that day and write it down in legal terms on a piece of paper. I'll sign it, maybe the attorney will sign it as a witness, and we'll stick it in the safe. Now, sure enough, a year or two, three later, I kick the bucket. And if my family's like all the rest of them, they're going to call that undertaker and say, come and get him. And let's get him out to that cemetery and get him in the ground just as soon as we can. Used to, they waited 4, 5, 6 days. Hell, today they do it in just 2 or 3 days. They don't waste any time. They take me out to that cemetery and I'm suspended over a hole in the ground in a big long box. Hopefully there'll be a few people standing around that box. And somebody might say a prayer, and hopefully it'll be an AA member that says the prayer. And they begin to drop me down in that hole. Well, my family's like the rest of them. They're not even going to wait till I get to the bottom of the hole. They're going to jump in the car, and they're going to go right back to the that attorney's office. And they're going to get out that piece of paper and they're going to read my thinking as of 2 or 3 years prior to that time when I was there in that attorney's office. We know that they call that piece of paper a will, not by accident. Will, thinking, mind, they're all synonymous. So I'm making a decision to turn my thinking apparatus over to the care and direction of God as I understand Him. What else am I deciding to turn over? Well, not only am I making a decision to turn my will over, I'm making a decision to turn my will and my life over to the care and direction of God as I understand Him. Now, what is my life? My life is nothing more than my actions. What I am right now, as of this moment, sitting behind this microphone, is the sum accumulative total of all the actions I've taken throughout my entire lifetime has made me just exactly what I am today. Now, we know all action is born in thought.
Say that again, please.
All action is born in thought. You know, sometimes we react to a situation so rapidly we think we do it automatically, but we really don't. I can't even reach out and pick up this cup of coffee unless my mind tells my body to do so. Well, if all action is born in thought, then that means my life is determined by the way that I think. And if I think right, my actions are probably going to be right, and my life's going to be pretty good. If my thinking is lousy, then chances are my actions are going to be lousy, and my life's going to be pretty lousy also. Now, I shall never forget when I come to step three. I went to my sponsor and I said, I don't believe I'm going to be able to take step three. He said, why? I said, because if I turn my will and my life over to the care of God as I understand Him, I have no idea what He would have me be. He may want me to be a missionary, and He may send me to China, and I sure as hell don't want to go to China. And he just laughed. He said, well, let's look at it this way. He said, at least it wouldn't be in the hands of an idiot, would it? He said, let's look back through your lifetime. He said, you've always been a selfish, self-centered, self-willed human being. You've always done what you wanted to do whenever you wanted to do it, and to hell with the rest of them. Is that right? And I said, well, you know it is. And he said, well, the end result is you have almost destroyed your life. And he said, just as importantly, you've almost destroyed the lives of those around you who care for you. He said, just think. If God could direct your thinking, it might become better. And if your thinking becomes better, then your actions are going to become better. And if your actions become better, then your life is going to become better. And he said, just as importantly, the lives of those around you that care for you will become better also. He said, Charlie, left on your own resources, you don't stand a chance. He said, you'll continue to think the way you always have. You'll continue to take the same old actions. You'll continue to destroy your life and the life of those around you that care for you. He stepped back about 3 feet, stuck his bony old finger right in the middle of my chest, and he said, now you have to make a decision. He said, I wish I could do it for you, but I can't. This is one you'll have to make yourself. And he put it through to me in such a manner that I could really begin to see that I really did need to try to turn my will and my life over to the care and direction of God as I understand Him, Joe.
Okay. And it goes on to say, the first requirement is that we be convinced that any life run on self-will could hardly be a success. You know, we talked about the directions precisely, specifically with clear-cut directions. Well, here's some of the directions. The first requirement is that we be convinced that any life run on self-will can hardly be a success. On that basis, we're almost always in collision with something or somebody, even though our motives are good. Most people try to live by self-propulsion. Each person is like an actor who wants to run the whole show. is forever trying to arrange the lights, the ballet, the scenery, and the rest of the players in his own way. If his arrangements would only stay put, if only people would do as he wished, the show would be great. Everybody, including himself, would be pleased. Life would be wonderful. Now, wouldn't that be true? If everybody would just mind me and do what I tell them to do, they would be happier. I know they would be, and I would be happier. There's only one thing. God gave us all a self-will. Now, my wife has a self-will. And my will for my wife is one thing. And her will for her is another. And every time I try to impose my will on her, we have trouble. Big trouble. Get into lots of problems when I try to do that. The first requirement is I be convinced any life run on self-will could hardly be a success. I have to quit doing that. 12 or 13 years after Bill got sober and wrote the big book, he wrote the 12 and 12. Primarily, he wrote the 12 and 12 to pitch the traditions to us. He's having trouble selling the traditions to us, the fellowship. So we put some information about the steps in there. Short stories, the way he put it. Short essays about the steps. Knowing if we put that in there, maybe we would eventually read the traditions, which is what he really wanted us to know about. But after 12 or 13 years, Bill had a lot of experience with us. We didn't know about self, about will, and what made up self. That's the reason we had trouble with that third column in the fourth step. Most people, at least I did, had trouble with that third column. What part of self was affected? I didn't know what self was or how it could be affected, so therefore I just skipped over that third column. Couldn't do it because I didn't have any information about it. But in the 12 and 12 regarding the fourth step, the first three or four pages of that talks about self in great detail. He didn't explain it in the big book, but in the 12 and 12 he did. And I think that for me, when I sponsor people, I have them go to the 12 and 12, read the first three or four pages about self, find out the basic instincts of life and the working knowledge of it, so they can do the third column in the inventory out of the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I think that's what he's trying to do here. He's explaining a little bit about self.
You can't really do much about a problem unless you understand the problem. And I found it was very difficult for me to even think about getting rid of self-will, because I didn't know where self-will came from. And thank God that Bill explained it to us in the 12 and 12. You know, I think we've all got to recognize the fact that Bill Wilson, when he wrote the big book, had only been sober a little over 3 years. He was not a great spiritual giant. He was not a great student of human nature. He was a night school lawyer and a New York City stock speculator. Yet he was able to write one of the most spiritual books dealing with human nature the world's ever seen when he wrote the big book, Alcoholics Anonymous. He did the absolute best that he could. Surely, surely, God used Bill's hand to write the big book. I don't think Bill could have done it by himself. 12 or 13 years later, though, Bill has studied with some of the best minds in the world regarding spirituality. Bill had worked with many, many alcoholics. He understood a lot more about spirituality and human nature in 1950, 51, and 52 than he knew back in 1939. And I think he had some more information that he wanted to give to us so that we would better be able to work the steps according to the big book Alcoholics Anonymous. And he wrote the 12 and 12. And one of the great mistakes we see people today doing, they're trying to work the steps out of the 12 and 12. But you can't work the steps out of the 12 and 12 because there's no directions on how to work them. He said that it's a series of essays designed to give us more information so that we can better work the steps according to the big book Alcoholics Anonymous. On step four in the 12 and 12, in a matter of about two or three pages, he taught me more about what makes me tick, what makes me think the way I think and act the way I act, than I had ever learned before in 40-some-odd years of living. And when I saw that and can really understand it, then I can really begin to see why it's necessary for to make this decision to turn my will and my life over to the care of God as I understand Him. And we're going to put a little picture up here for just a few minutes. You got one of them in your book to match it. We're going to borrow just a little of that information out of the 12 and 12. And I think it'll make it a lot easier on us in step 3. And certainly it's going to lay the groundwork for us when we get to step 4. So let's look at this for just a few minutes. In the first couple of pages on step 4 in the 12 and 12, he talks about the 3 basic instincts of life which create this thing called self-will. He talks about the social instinct, the security instinct, and the sex instinct. And he said all human beings are born with these separate instincts as a part of their makeup. He said if we didn't have those instincts, that the human race would simply fail to survive. And the first one we talk about is called the social instinct. And he said all human beings are born with a desire to be liked, to be accepted, to be respected by others, to be able to come together in groups with other human beings. And he said if we didn't have that social instinct, we would care nothing about each other. The world would go into complete anarchy. Dog eat dog would reign. And sooner or later, under those conditions, the human race would simply fail to survive. So those desires that you and I have to be a part of, to be recognized by other people, to join together in groups with other human beings, it is a basic God-given thing. It's a good thing. It's necessary for our survival. He uses several words underneath the social instinct. He talks about companionship. That's nothing more than wanting to belong or to be accepted by other people. So many of us grew up on the outside of the crowd looking in, wanting to be a part of and knew that we could not be, even though we desperately wanted to do so. That's one of the reasons we love to drink so well. He uses the word prestige. Prestige is wanting to be recognized or to be accepted as the leader of the group. The world needs leaders. I guess even back in the old caveman days, somebody had to say, John, get behind that tree with your spear. Mary Jo, get over there with your club. And we'll run this sucker through here and we'll jump him and kill him. We'll have something to eat. Somebody has to do that. And most people take one of two directions. Either let me be a part of, or let me be the leader of. And in either case, it's going to be based upon what other people think of us. If they seem to like us and accept us and recognize us, then we can be a part of, or we can be the leader. He talks about self-esteem. Self-esteem is what we think of ourselves. And usually that's either high or low. If other people seem to accept us as a part of their group, then we feel pretty good about ourselves. But if they reject us, or we even think they reject us, we feel pretty lousy toward ourselves. In either case, it's usually not true. We either think too little or too much. He talked about pride. I'm glad I got in the habit of going to the dictionary. As a kid growing up, all I ever wanted to be was a man who walked tall with pride, and a little bit sideways like John Wayne did. But when I went to the dictionary and I looked it up, and I found that I don't want to deal with this pride thing, because the dictionary defines it as an excessive and unjustified opinion of oneself. We either think too well of ourselves, or we think too low of ourselves, one of the two. Personal relationships. That's nothing more than our relations with other human beings and the world around us. Ambitions. Ambitions are our plans to gain acceptance, power, recognition, prestige, and etc. Revolves around our plans for the future. Now, if I wanted to be liked and accepted and respected by other people, well, the first thing I've got to find out is, well, what do they expect from me? What do I need to become? Society teaches us those things as we grow up and we reach adulthood. In some parts of the world, you need a good education to be liked and accepted and respected. Another part of the world, perhaps, is to be a large landowner. Another part of the world is to be a good fisherman. Another part of the world is to be a good farmer. It can be any number of different things. And we're taught those things by society as we grow up. And based on what we're taught, then we set goals for ourselves to get the education, to be the landowner, to be whatever it is that we decide we need to be. Now, if you're going to reach the goal and be accepted and recognized by other people, you're going to have to work at it. You can't just be a bum and sit on your duff and have people like you and accept you and respect you. By the same token, you're probably going to have to make some sacrifices. You know, there are some things that I would really like to do as a human being that are very exciting and very pleasurable. But if I do them and you catch me at it, you're not going to like me at all. And I don't think you and I would do the work necessary, nor make the sacrifices necessary, unless we got some reward for doing so. The great reward comes at the moment of successful completion of the goal. Bill said it in his story when he said, "I had arrived." How many of us have set that goal? Literally worked our tail off for years to get there. We become successful and they pat us on the back and they say, "Oh, Joe, you're a good man, you're a smart individual, you're really a great guy." And there becomes a feeling over us that's one of those indescribably wonderful feelings when we get that recognition. The only thing wrong with it, though, it seems to be just a temporary feeling. Hell, you no sooner get the recognition, you feel good over it, and you look around and you say, "Well, is this all there is to it?" And we set another goal. And we work and we work and we strive and we strive and we reach the new goal. We get the recognition, it feels good, doesn't last long, and we set another goal. And it seems to create within we human beings an insatiable desire for more and more power, more and more recognition, more and more and more. And they're not giving it to us fast enough. We're not getting it the way we think we ought to get it. So what do? Well, we start taking shortcuts. We start doing a little lying, a little conning, a little manipulating, a little stepping on other people's toes and climbing on their backs. And the instant we do so, we create pain and suffering for others. They in turn retaliate against us and create pain and suffering for us. This plain little life run on self-will can hardly ever be a success, because under those conditions we're always in collision with people and places and things. He talked about another basic instinct. He called it the security instinct. He said all human beings are born with a desire to be secure in the future. He said if we didn't have that desire, we wouldn't provide the food, the clothing, the shelter, the protection, the things that we have to have in order to survive. Next winter season, we would just freeze to death. Next drought season, we would simply starve to death. Now, I know in AA we try to live one day at a time, but I also know everybody in this room has got an insurance policy. And the purpose of an insurance policy is to protect ourselves in the future. A basic, God-given instinct, and it's a good thing. But just like with the social instinct, if you're going to be secure in the future, the first thing you have to do is decide, well, what is it I need to be secure? Society teaches us that as we grow up. In one part of the world, they need $4. Another part of the world, they need $4,000. Another part of the world, they need $4 million. Another part of the world, they need 192 coconuts, whatever it is they use to measure and trade and barter with. And we start setting goals for ourselves. Now, if you're going to reach the goal and be secure in the future, you're going to have to work at it. You can't just sit on your duff and be a bum and be secure in the future. By the same token, we're going to have to make some sacrifices. I can't blow it all today on what I want if I want to be secure in the future. And I don't think we would do the work necessary nor make the sacrifices necessary to be secure in the future unless we get a reward for doing so. And the great reward comes at the moment of successful completion of the goal. My God, how many of those goals have we set for ourselves? As a kid growing up, I set the goal for a bicycle. And when I was a kid, you could buy a used bicycle for about $6. And hell, it took me 2 years to save $6. And one day I got that bicycle, and my God, what a great feeling that was. Nobody could take that thing away from me. We set the goal for the new dress, for the new suit, for the new couch, for the new house, for the new piece of property, for the new business. And we work and we work and we strive and we strive. And the day they can't take it away from us, by golly, it's one of the greatest feelings in the world. When I was a kid growing up, hardly anybody owned their own home. And once in a great while, somebody would gather enough money together to make a down payment on a little old 3 or 4 room shack. And they would pay and pay and pay and pay and pay and pay. And the day that sucker was paid off, you know what they did? They called in all the neighbors and we had a party. And we celebrated by burning the mortgage because nobody could take it away from us now. What a great feeling. But also, just like with a social instinct, no sooner do I get that recognition, it becomes mine, nobody can touch it. I look around and I say, well, hell, this guy here's got a Cadillac and I'm still in a Chevrolet. This guy over here's got a Brooks Brothers suit and I bought mine at Kmart's. And that causes me to set another goal. And I work and I work and I strive and I strive and I sacrifice and I reach the new goal and it feels good, but it doesn't last long and I set another goal. And it seems to create an insatiable desire within we human beings for more and more and more and more, and we're not getting it fast enough, not giving it to us like we think they should. So what do? We take shortcuts. We lie. We cheat. We con. We manipulate. We step on other people's toes and climb on their backs, and the instant we do so, we create pain and suffering for others. They in turn retaliate against us and create pain and suffering for us. Plain a life run on self-will can hardly ever be a success, because under those conditions we're always in collision with people, places, and things. The third basic instinct he talks about is the sex instinct. And before I get into sex, I always have to stop and take a drink of coffee here. He said all human beings are born with a desire to have sex. Now, it may get turned off by bad teachings and bad happenings. But he said all human beings are born with a desire to have sex because if we don't have sex, we can't reproduce ourselves. And if we don't reproduce ourselves, then sooner or later, the human race is going to fail to survive. Now, just like the other two instincts, if you're going to reproduce yourself through the sexual act, you're going to have to work at it. Hell, you can do more work in 3 minutes of sex if you can last that long than you'll do all day digging a ditch. Don't you older guys remember how it used to be when you got through with it? My God, you just fell over sideways. The sweat's just pouring off of you. You can hardly get your breath. You feel like you've died, gone to heaven, and come back 2 or 3 times. And I don't think we would do that kind of work if we didn't get a reward for doing so. And the great reward we get is that great feeling, both physically and emotionally, at the moment of successful completion of the sex act, one of the greatest feelings a human being can possibly experience. But also, just like the other two, it's just a temporary feeling. Hell, you no sooner get through with doing it than you get to thinking about doing it again. And it's such a pleasurable thing, the next thing you know, you get to thinking about doing it in different ways. You get to thinking about doing it in different positions. I'm going to lose my voice. We get to thinking about doing it in different positions, and next thing you know, we get to thinking about doing it with different people. And the next thing you know, we're doing it at the wrong time and the wrong way with the wrong people. The instant we do so, we create pain and suffering for others. They, in turn, retaliate against us and create pain and suffering for us. Pain that a life run on self-will can hardly ever be a success because under those conditions we're always in collision with people, places, and things. Now, if you'll notice on that little chart, you got a little circle there called self. That's where self-will comes from. It comes from the satisfaction, the fulfilling of these three basic instincts of life. You'll notice also coming out of self, there's one called wrongs, which is another word we have to look at. Somewhere in AA, we got the idea that wrongs would be a list of dirty, filthy, nasty items. But if you go to the dictionary, you'll find several definitions of it. One definition I found of the word wrong is incorrect judgment of others. A little later on, we're going to find out that's exactly what a resentment is. Another definition of the word wrong is incorrect believing. A little later on, we're going to see that's where most of our fears are incorrect believing. They're not true. Another definition of the word wrong is the harms and the hurts that we do to other human beings. It's very easy to spot a selfish, self-centered human being. They will always display three common manifestations of self. They're always madder than hell. Damn him and damn her, and by God, I'll show them, and they're not going to treat me that way, and blah, 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 blah. A selfish, self-centered human being is always scared to death. Can't depend on God. Can't depend on other human beings. If they're approaching the end of the road in alcoholism, they can't depend on themselves anymore. And they're running around absolutely scared to death. We don't know what's going to happen tomorrow, but we know when it gets here, it's not going to be worth a damn, whatever it is. A selfish, self-centered human being is always doing things to fulfill the three basic instincts of life that creates harms and hurts for other people. And we're not drunken bums. We've got a conscience. And we do these things that hurt other people, and then the guilt and the remorse associated with those things just literally eat us up. And a selfish, self-centered human being doesn't have any peace of mind, serenity, and happiness at all. Now, we're trying to find a way to live where not only can we be sober, but we can have a little peace of mind and serenity and happiness so that we don't have to go back to drinking. But if we continue to operate on self-will, we rob ourselves of any chance for happiness, peace of mind, serenity, and etc. through the overdoing of the three basic instincts of life. You know, if every human being on earth today could fulfill these three basic instincts of life at the level that God intended, there would be no conflict on earth today. Every emotional problem that we human beings have will stem from one of these three basic instincts of life. Trying to have our own way, trying to do things the way we want to, trying to fulfill this social, this security, and this sex instinct. All human beings have self-will. All human beings overdo in one or more of these areas from time to time. All human beings run in conflict with other people and places and things because of the fulfillment of the three basic instincts of life. You know, I think God knew that we would never do the work necessary to do these things if we didn't get the great rewards that come from the fulfillment of them. I think He also knew that sooner or later we were going to destroy ourselves through trying to fulfill them, and eventually we might have to turn back to Him and give Him back self-will so we could start operating on God's will in order to have a little peace of mind and happiness.
I thought I was going to have to finish that sex deal for him.
Well, I did too for a minute.
I was dreading that. Okay, on page 61, he said, well, what usually happens? We're trying to satisfy these basic instincts of life. The show doesn't come off very well. He begins to think that life doesn't treat him right. He decides to exert himself more. He becomes, on the next occasion, still more and more demanding or gracious, as the case may be. Still, the play does not suit him. Admitting he may be somewhat at fault, he's sure that other people are more to blame. He becomes angry, indignant, and self-pitying. What is his basic trouble? Is he not really a self-seeker, even when trying to be kind? Is he not a victim of the delusion that he can wrest satisfaction and happiness out of this world if he only manages well? Is it not evident to all the rest of the players that these are the things he wants? And do not his actions make each of them wish to retaliate, snatching all they can get out of the show? Is he not even in his best moments a producer of confusion rather than harmony? Our actor is a self-centered, egocentric, as people call it, now like to call it today. He is like the retired businessman who lolls in the Florida sunshine in the winter complaining of the sad state of the nature. The minister who signs over the sins of the 20th century. Politicians and reformers who assure that all would be utopia if the rest of the world would only behave. The outlaw safecracker who thinks society has wronged him. And the alcoholic lost all and is locked up. Whatever his protestations are not most of his us concerned with ourselves, our resentments, and our self-pity? Selfishness and self-centeredness. That, we think, is the root of our troubles. We're driven by 100 forms of fear, self-delusion, self-seeking, self-pity. We step on the toes of our fellows and they retaliate. Sometimes they hurt us seemingly without provocation. But we invariably find that sometime in the past, we've made decisions based on self, which later put us in a position to be hurt. We find that sometime in the past, we've made decisions based upon the satisfaction of those basic instincts of life, which later put us in a position to be hurt. So our troubles, we think, are basically of our own making. They arise out of ourselves. And the alcoholic is an extreme example of self-will run riot, though he usually doesn't think so. Above everything, we alcoholics must be rid of this selfishness. We must, or it kills us. And God makes that possible. And there often seems no way of entirely getting rid of self without his aid. Many of us have had moral and philosophical convictions galore, but we could not live up to them even though we would like to. Neither could we reduce our self-centeredness much by wishing or trying on our own power. We had to have God's help. And again, we can't heal a sick mind with a sick mind. Can't wish our way out of it, can't think our way out of it. We have to have God's help.
This is the how and why of it. First of all, we had to quit playing God. You know, everything that I read today leads me to believe that this is a God-directed world. And those of us that have been trying to be self-directed, and those of us that have been trying to direct everything and everybody around us, we've been trying to do God's work for Him. And we're not God. We've just been playing at being God. Next, we decided hereafter in this drama of life, God was going to be our director. Not our suggester. He's got his word back now. He'll carry it all the way through from now on. He is the principal. We are his agents. He is the father. We are his children. Most good ideas are simple. And this concept was the keystone of the new and triumphant arch through which we pass to freedom. And once again, he's referring to that wonderfully effective spiritual structure. Willingness, step one, was the foundation. Believing, step two, was the cornerstone. Now he tells us it's going to be an arch, and we're going to pass through it to freedom. And the keystone of that arch, which is the stone at the top, that all the others lean against and support that arch, the keystone is the simple little idea that we're going to let God be the director. And that's a real change in our thinking when we make that decision.
I almost missed that simple little idea there that we're talking about. Of course, when I first started praying, I said, God, help me to get my wife back. I wanted her back. It took 2.5 years for that. And I said, by the way, help me make more money. I need a new car. And, you know, I used God like he would an errand boy. Send him out to take care of stuff. And after I've been sober a while, I've been reading that other big book, and it says that he worked for 6 days and then he rested. Out of my knowledge, he never did go back to work anymore. It looks to me like there's going to be work being done around here. It's going to be me. See, he's the principal. We're the agents. He's the father. We're the children. Most good ideas are simple. He's the boss. I work for him. I'm supposed to perform his work well. I thought he was supposed to do what I wanted to do. and be an errand boy for me. That's not, almost missed that simple idea.
Now, here's the results of this decision that we've just made.
When we sincerely took such a position, that one, he's the father, we're the children, he's the principal, we're the agents, all sorts of remarkable things followed. We had a new employer. Being all-powerful, he provided what we needed if we kept close to him and performed his work well. See, I'm supposed to perform his work well. Established on such a footing, we became less and less interested in ourselves, our little plans and designs. More and more, we became interested in seeing what we could contribute to life. See, I'd always been a taker. Takers are losers, you know. Not only in AA, but in life. Takers are losers. I was one of them. Now I'm trying to see what I can contribute to life. As we felt new power flow in, as we enjoyed peace of mind, as we discovered we could face life successfully, as we became conscious of his presence, we began to lose our fear of day, today, tomorrow, or the hereafter. We were reborn. And boy, I used to hate that idea about being reborn. Those people from that church used to come down to my house on Monday night and knock on the door and want to talk to me about being reborn. And you know what I told them? I said, hey, guys, come in. Today and tonight is Monday Night Football. And you guys here are talking about that stuff. I want you to get your stuff together and get out of here. Now, that's the nice version of it. I wouldn't talk to them about anything. I'd like to talk about being reborn. And after I'd been sober a while, I read that other book about this guy named Nicodemus. Nicodemus was just like me, dumb as a rock. I mean, really. He went to this white fellow who was talking about being reborn, and he said, you mean I have to go back into my mother's womb and be reborn? That's the way he understood it. He looked at him and shook his head like Charlie shook his head at me many times. And he said, man, don't you educated? Didn't you go to college? Don't you know anything? When I'm talking to you about being reborn, I'm talking to you about the renewing of your mind. Old ideas cast aside, the new ones accepted. Then you are reborn. I could buy that. I could understand that. Now I'm ready to do step three. And I knew what today we were going to do at that little church up there on Sunday morning. They always did. They're still doing it. They're basically asking people to come there and do the third step prayer, basically. And so the next Sunday morning, I couldn't wait to get there. Our book said we are now at step three after I understood some more things. And I went down there on Sunday morning, got there about 2 or 3 minutes before 11. Well, I didn't want to get there too early. I might hear something that helped me, you know. So I got there about 2 or 3 minutes before 11, and sure enough, they'd asked people to come and do the third step prayer. And I went down there as humbly and as sincerely and as honestly as I know how to do anything. And this is what I said. I said, God, I offer myself to you to be with me and do with me as you will. Relieve me of the bondage of self that I may better do your will. Take away my difficulties that victory over them may bear witness to those that I would help of your power, your love, and your way of life. May I do your will always. We thought well before making this step, making sure that we were ready, that we could at last abandon ourselves utterly to him. Now, I don't know what happened that particular morning. I'm not smart enough to know. But I do know this. From that day to this day, my life hadn't been the same. That I know. It's like I've been walking on the dark side of the street for all those 34 years. And now, on these last 33 years, I'm walking in the sunny side of the street. Everything's been good. I went over to my mother's house that afternoon because I was by myself, and she fixed dinner for me. And she looked at me and said, Benny Joe, that's my name. She said, Benny Joe, said, what's happened to you? They always want to know. She said, just somehow you're different. You know, and I told her what I had done that morning. And she smiled. And that's all my mother ever wanted from me and her kids was to live that way. That's all she ever wanted, no big deal. But I somehow couldn't do it. She was happy about that. Later on, I went to see my wife, Phyllis. I used to call her up and she'd just hang up the phone. Call up and Gail, my little daughter, would answer and she'd hang up the phone. I wanted to get my family back, you see. Finally, Phyllis was able to, we were able to talk. And I was her Abby, she said, after almost 3 years. I went over to the house that day, and if she was telling a story, she said, she opened the door, and there I stood, fresh-skinned and glowing. She said there was something about his eyes. He was different. And we went in and talked a little bit. And she said, "What's happened to you? You're different. You can hold a cup of coffee without shaking. You're not using nasty language with me anymore. What's happened?" And I told her about this decision that I made. And she was happy. Eventually she got sober. See, they always want to know what happened, don't they? Remember, Bill asked Abby, said, "Come, what's this all about?" he queried. He wanted to know what happened. There was a story in that other big book. They asked that guy, he said, "What happened to you?" He said, "I don't know what happened." He said, "I was blind and now I can see. See, I was sober. I was drunk and now I'm sober. That's all I know of what happened as a result of the third step. And my life hasn't been the same since that morning, way back when." It's really the program, as far as I know, today starts at step three, when we make that decision. And how well we make that decision is going to determine the quality of our life from now on. That's the way I see it anyhow.
We thought well before taking this step, making sure we were ready, that we could at last abandon ourselves utterly to Him. I think utterly means completely, wholeheartedly, the whole ball of wax. I'd hate for you guys to make the decision that I made when I, or the mistake that I made when I took step three. I got down on my knees, which I very seldom did in those days. I said, "God, I offer myself to Thee to build with me and do with me as Thou wilt," so on, so forth. And as I finished it up, I said, "Now this applies to my alcohol. Don't fool with my sex life. Don't worry about my money. I'll take care of that too."
God probably said, "What an order. I can't go through with it."
I said, you take the alcohol and I'll take care of the rest." And today I realize the fallacy in that kind of thinking is God don't want the alcohol. Hell, He probably doesn't even drink. What He really wants is me. And He wants all of me. Not just some of my thinking, but all of my thinking. Abandon ourselves utterly to Him. We found it very desirable to take this spiritual step with an understanding person, such as our wife, best friend, or spiritual advisor. But it's better to meet God alone than one who might misunderstand. The wording was, of course, quite optional, so long as we expressed the idea, voicing it without reservation. This was only a beginning. Though if honestly and humbly made, an effect, sometimes a very great one, was felt at once. Now we're going to ask you to do a favor for us. You don't have to do it if you don't want to, but we're going to ask you to do it anyhow. We'd like for you to reach out and hold hands with those on each side of you, if you can possibly reach them. And I'm going to read this step, and as I read it, I'd like for you to repeat it after me. "God, I offer myself to Thee."
To God, I offer myself to Thee.
"To build with me and do with me as Thou wilt."
To build with me and do with me as I will.
"Relieve me of the bondage of self."
Relieve me of the bondage of self.
"That I may better do Thy will."
That I may better do Thy will.
"Take away my difficulties."
Take away my difficulties.
"That victory over them may bear witness."
That victory over them may bear witness.
"To those I would help of Thy power."
To those that I would help of Thy power.
"Thy love."
Thy love.
"And Thy way of life."
And Thy way of life.
"May I do Thy will always."
May I do Thy will always.
Amen.
Amen. Thank you. Yeah.
You'll never have to worry about whether you've taken step three or not. You just now took it again. Yeah. I keep hearing people today talk about, "I've been working on step three for a year." Hell, you take step three in a matter of seconds. It don't take any long time to do that. Now, let's go a little further in this thing. It says, "Next we launched out on a course of vigorous action. The first step of which is a personal house cleaning, which many of us never attempted. Though our decision,"
step three,
"was a vital and crucial step, It could have little permanent effect unless at once followed by a strenuous effort to face and be rid of the things in ourselves which had been blocking us. Our liquor was but a symptom, so we had to get down to causes and conditions. And the first thing we like to look at here is the time element between step 3 and step 4. And we hear this question asked all the time in AA. How long should you wait to do step 4 after you've done step 3? We hear all kind of answers. 30 days, 60 days, 3 months, 6 months. We heard a professional in the field counseling people to wait a minimum of 2 years. And our question to that professional was, how many people have you killed with that statement? See, we're trying to find a way to live where not only can we be sober, but we can be peaceful and happy and free, so we don't have to go back to drinking again. The longer we put off step 4, the longer we're going to remain restless, irritable, and discontented. The longer we're going to be filled with shame and fear and guilt and remorse and etc. And we're going to run around that way just so long. And after a while, our mind's going to seek relief. It's going to start thinking about the sense of ease and comfort that comes at once by taking a couple of drinks. Next thing you know, we think we can drink. We end up drunk all over again. And for many of us, we end up dying from alcoholism. The big book tells you when to take step 4. It says step 3 is going to have little permanent effect unless at once followed by the strenuous effort to face and be rid of the things in ourselves which had been blocking us. That really does make sense anyhow, doesn't it? For as I know, step 4 or 4 is always followed immediately after 3. So knowing that we might end up getting drunk if we don't take step 4, then why do we tend to want to procrastinate on it and keep putting it off and putting it off and putting it off? Probably 2 or 3 reasons. Number one, I think some of the older members tend to play king off of the mountain with this step, and they tell the newcomer how hard it is. By God, you just wait till you get to step 4. Blah, 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 blah. We literally scare them to death. Let us be the first to say today that if we do step 4 according to the Big Book Alcoholics, there is nothing to be afraid of, period. Our problem with step 4 has always been, the instructions are here on page 64, but not understanding how Bill Wilson writes, we never could really see what he wanted us to do. So we got over into step 5. And in step 5, it said something about sharing all your life story. And we said, oh, that must be what they wanted us to do then. For step 4 was write our life story and then share it in step 5. And that's what many of us did. My life story probably wasn't too important to other people, but it must have been important to me because I had about 92 pages in it when I got through with it. I took it to another poor, suffering alcoholic and asked him to read it. And he read it and he said, not very pretty, is it? And I said, no, it isn't. He said, you'll never have to be that way again. And he threw it in the waste paper basket. I learned nothing to contribute to my alcoholism from the writing of my life story. Now, maybe if the guy that I did step 5 with had known what he was talking about, he could have helped me with it, but he didn't know any more about it than I did. And as I look back at it now, 95% of my life story has nothing to do with my alcoholism. The fact that I was born in 1929, that has nothing to do with my alcoholism. May have something to do with somebody else's alcoholism, but not mine. The fact that I graduated from high school at age 17 has nothing to do with my alcoholism. The fact that I went into service immediately after graduating from high school has nothing to do with my alcoholism. The fact that I was married at age 21 has nothing to do with my alcoholism. But I tell you what it did do. The 95% that had nothing to do with it very effectively covered up the 5% that did, and I learned nothing to contribute to my alcoholism from the writing of my life story. So in our confusion, somebody in Minneapolis, Minnesota wrote a four-step inventory guide. We took it and combined it with a big book, and we got more confused yet. Somebody in Dallas, Texas wrote a four-step inventory guide. We combined it with a Minneapolis guide with a big book, and then we really got confused. I have no idea how many of them are floating around out there today. We saw one that had a total of 22 pages in it. If you wasn't crazy as hell before you took it, you would be when you were through with it. It was one of those kinds. All the time, the instructions have been right here. We just didn't understand the way Bill writes. So let's just kind of sit back. Let's kind of relax. Let's look at a few words. And let's see if we can't see how simple step four really is.
I want to indicate here that it's about 4:15 when we started the fourth step. And we finished with the fourth step, but tomorrow it'll be very little time. It will be very simple. That anybody can do it within about 2 or 3 hours. It don't take days and weeks to do the four step. Simplicity will be the key.
Now, in order to do that, we got to remember two things about Bill Wilson. First, he loves to make comparisons between something we already know about and then something else to teach us something new. The second thing he loved to do is to use different words when he repeats himself. He didn't like to use the same words over and over and over. So we're going to look at a few words here on page 64. Joe's putting a little diagram up here on the board. And on this little diagram, we're calling it the inventory comparison. And what we're going to do is we're going to compare the words that Bill uses here in the book with the actual wording of the fourth step inventory itself. He said, therefore, we started upon a personal inventory. This was step four. Now, immediately he leaves personal and jumps into business. He says, a business which takes no regular inventory usually goes broke. And you and I would probably agree with that. If you had a business, I don't care what it is, selling ladies' purses, men's watches, bicycles, or whatever, if you didn't inventory in there once in a while, you wouldn't know where you stand. If you didn't inventory, you wouldn't know what's been stolen out of your store that you didn't get paid for. If you didn't inventory once in a while, you wouldn't know what's been sold and you need to reorder new stock to take its place. If you didn't inventory once in a while, you wouldn't know what's become out of style. Nobody really wants to buy it. You need to put it on sale and get it out of your store. It's sitting there taking up valuable floor space and shelf space where you could have some good items in stock. If you didn't inventory once in a while, you wouldn't know what's become damaged and unsaleable. And nobody wants to buy that, so you need to get it out of the store. You probably pay an interest on borrowed money. And that stuff that's unsaleable just sits there day after day after day, taking up space and costing you money. If you didn't inventory once in a while, you probably would end up going broke. I think we could all agree with that. Now, his first comparison is comparing the business inventory to the personal inventory. In our lives, we have a business also. And our personal business is the business of finding a way to live, where we can have a little peace of mind, serenity, and happiness, and we don't have to go back to drinking again. And if we don't inventory in our personal business, we're probably going to go broke too. And going broke for us would simply be going back to getting drunk over and over and over and over. So I think his first comparison, whether it's business or personal, without an inventory, we're probably going to go broke. Now we're going to take some key words out of here. He says, taking a commercial. Now, Dad Burnham, he could have said business again. But he don't want to use the same word twice, so he'll call it commercial this time. Taking a commercial inventory is a fact-finding. And Joe's putting fact-finding up there on the board underneath the business side of it. It is a fact-finding and a fact-facing process. We're putting fact-facing under the business inventory. It is an effort to discover the truth, and we're putting truth under the business inventory. About the stock in trade, we're putting stock in trade under inventory. The stock in trade are those items we've got in there to sell. The ladies' purses, the men's watches, the bicycles, or whatever. One object is to disclose damaged or unsaleable goods, and we're putting damaged or unsaleable goods under the business side, and to get rid of them promptly and without regret. And we're putting promptly and without regret under the business side. In other words, we're going to try to find in that business the damaged and unsaleable goods, those things that are costing us money on a daily basis. We're going to try to discover the truth about them. When we see the truth, we're going to try to get rid of them promptly and without regret. Because as long as they're in there, we're losing money on them. We've got to get them out of there so we can put new items in their place. In other words, we are looking for the stock in trade that is damaged. We don't go broke on the good items. They keep selling day after day after day, and we're making money on them. The old, out-of-style, damaged, and unsaleable goods is what causes us to go broke. Anybody have any quarrel with that? Makes sense, doesn't it? Now watch him. He wrote a step for us, and he used a series of words that mean exactly the same thing. In step four, he said we made a personal inventory. He said we made a searching, and we're putting searching straight across from fact-finding. Means identically the same thing. To find the facts, to search out the facts. We made a searching and fearless. We're putting fearless straight across from fact-facing, which means the same thing. To face those facts as they really are, to look at them fearlessly. We made a searching and fearless moral. And there's where we got in trouble. We said, oh crap, there it is. There's that list of dirty, filthy, nasty items. And we don't want to look at them ourselves, and we sure as hell don't want to show them to another human being. I'm not sure what old Bill Wilson knew. But I know one thing, this guy understood the English language. And I think if he'd wanted you and I to make a list of dirty, filthy, nasty items, he would have said, we made a searching and fearless amoral or immoral inventory. He didn't say that. He said moral. And it bugged us, and it bugged us, and it bugged us. Till finally one day we went back to the dictionary. And moral is defined in the dictionary as nothing in the world but truth. The things as they really are. The right and wrong of any given situation. So moral and truth means the same thing. We made a searching and fearless moral inventory of what? Of ourselves. We're the only stock in trade that we have in this business of staying sober. And nobody else can make us sober. And nobody else can make us drink. Now I'll agree they can make us thirsty as hell once in a while. But they can't make us drink. We decide whether we drink or not. Now, what part of us decides whether we drink or not? Is it our body? Or is it our mind? I'm going to look into my head. And I'm going to try to find the damaged and unsaleable goods that block me off from carrying out this decision I've just made in step three. And there are three common manifestations of self-will that blocks God out of our life. We've already talked about them. I'm going to find those flawed thinking processes. When I find them, I'm going to get rid of them promptly and without regret. And they are resentments, fear, and harms done to others. And as long as those things are running around in my mind, then God can direct my thinking. My resentments direct the way I think. My fears direct the way I think. My harms I've done to others with the resultant guilt and remorse directs the way I think. And as long as they direct it, then God can't, and it's just that simple. Now, I like to look at my head up here as just a little bitty store. Not much. A little 7-Eleven. Come and get it, or get and go, or whatever you want to call them. Not a hell of a lot in it. But over here in this part of my store, I've got some display cases. And they're filled with resentments. Damn her, and damn him, and by God, they'll not treat me that way. And the next time I see them, I'm going to do this, and they're going to do that, and I'm going to say this, and waka, I'm going to put it on them. I'll show them that. God can't get into that part of my mind. Those display cases are already full. He's very effectively blocked out by those resentments that are in there. They control the way I think, and God can't. Over here in this part of my little store, I've got a file cabinet, and it's filled with fear. Oh, my God. What's she going to say when she finds out what I've been doing this time? Oh, my God. What's the banker going to say when that check gets there? He already told me he'd follow me. Oh, my God. Is that my car sitting out in the front with the front end torn up? No. Oh, my God. And on and on and on. God can't get in that file cabinet. It's already filled with fear. He's very effectively blocked out. Back here in the back of my store, I've got a storage room, and it's filled with guilt and remorse associated with the harms I've done to people in the past. We alcoholics are not drunken bums. Drunken bums about where they want to be. They're not too interested in changing. We're there with the drunken bum, but we don't want to be there. We have a conscience, and the guilt and remorse associated with those things just literally eats us up. And that storeroom is full of guilt and remorse, and God can't get in there. He's very effectively blocked out. Now, if I want Him to direct my thinking, then I'm going to have to do something about the removal of resentments. I'm going to have to do something about the removal of fear. I'm going to have to do something about the removal of guilt and remorse. You know, God told us way back in the beginning when He put us out of the garden and we started down the road, He said, wait, hold on just a minute. I want to make a deal with you. He said, if you would like to come back in this garden, I'll take care of you just like I do everything else. But He said, before you come back in here, you're going to have to give your self-will back to me, what I have so freely given to you. But He said, I love you enough that I'll let you stay out there on self-will until you destroy yourself. And the only way I can give it back to God is to first clean it up. And if I can get rid of these things that blocks Him out of my mind, then I can give my self-will back to God. And it's such a simple little process that it blows my mind every time I look at it. He said, we did exactly the same thing with our lives. We took stock honestly, truthfully, morally. First, we searched out the flaws in our makeup which caused our failure. Being convinced that self manifested in various ways and what had defeated us, we considered its common manifestations. Resentment is the number one offender. It destroys more alcoholics than anything else. From its stem, all forms of spiritual disease. We've been not only mentally and physically ill, we've been spiritually sick. When the spiritual malady is overcome, we straighten out mentally and physically. In dealing with resentments, we set them on paper. Now, before we can set resentments on paper, maybe we ought to look at that word. Make sure that we understand it the way Bill understood it when he put it in here. The word resentment itself comes from two old words. The first one is the word re, R-E. And when you see R-E in front of another word, it always means to repeat or to do over again. Repaint, replay, re always means to do again. The last part of this word, sentiment, comes from an old, old word which means to feel. So the word resentment itself means to re-feel. or to feel over again. Now let's say that I'm going through life and somebody comes along and they do something to me that threatens one of my basic instincts of life. Maybe they threaten my self-esteem. Maybe they threaten a personal relationship. Maybe they threaten my plans for the future. Maybe they threaten my security. Maybe they threaten my sex life in some way. When they do that to me, it creates pain and suffering and hurt for me. Now that's not a resentment. When they do that for me or to me, then that's a wrong on their part for doing so. But it doesn't become a resentment until I go off in the next room or I sit down in my easy chair that evening and I replay that thing in my mind and I feel the pain the second time. And after a while I replay it again and I feel the pain the third time. Now the stupidity behind it is that they're not even here now. I'm sitting there doing it to myself and replaying that thing in my head and feeling the pain over and over and over and over. And I'm not always too honest with myself. Because as I replay that thing over and over and over, I tend to distort the picture just a little bit. I tend to make what they did a little bit worse. I tend to make what I did a little bit less. I tend to make the pain just a little bit deeper. And let me sit there and play it over long enough, I'm able to say to myself, well, hell, I was just standing there doing nothing. And they come along and did it to me, and it's all their damn fault. It's kind of like watching a football game. You know, you guys up here like football just like we like it down in Oklahoma and Arkansas. And you watch a football game on TV, and the quarterback throws a pass out there, and the receiver has to jump up in the air to catch that pass. Now, the opposing team have learned that the time to hit him is just as soon as the ball touches his fingers, they can hit him and maybe knock him loose from the ball. And they hit him and they turn him upside down. He's about 3 feet in the air, and he falls on his head, and his head goes one way, his body goes another way, his arm goes like this, his legs goes like, and he's laying there on the ground and he's hurt, and you can see that he's hurt. He's evident that he's hurt. But the football game is just like the game of life. You're not going to stop it for very long. They're going to run out there and check that guy out. And if he isn't hurt too bad, they'll pump a little air in him and get him up, and they'll start the game and they'll start playing again. If he's hurt too bad, they'll drag him off to the side and they'll put somebody else in his place and the game starts over again. Now the announcer up in the booth, though, he's got a resentment machine up there. Because after a while he says, let's look at that again. Only this time, it's in slow motion. Living color. My God, it looks twice as bad as it did the first time. You can see how far his head bent sideways, how far his leg went back the other way. You can really see the expression of pain on his face. And after a while, the announcer says, let's look at that again. Now, the football game's been going on for about 15 minutes. And the announcer's sitting there bouncing this guy up and down, up and down, up and down through that resentment machine. We alcoholics have in our head a little resentment replay machine. I guess everybody does, but we alcoholics, we really have one. And we get up in the morning, and we shine the lens on it, because we don't want to miss anything that day. We tune it up in living color. We shine it on the world all day long, and we record everything they do to us that day that's bad. We go home at night, sit down in our easy chair, play it over in our head, make ourselves sick, and blame it on them for doing so. Now, there are days, though, we have a bad day. There's days we've got the lenses clean, we've got her tuned up, we're shining it on the world, and they won't do anything bad to us that day.
That's a bad day for an alcoholic.
Bad day for an alcoholic. We got nothing to record. You know what we record those days? By God, we record what they're thinking. That's what we do. Is there any way that God can get in a mind filled with that kind of crap? No way. Because as long as we're thinking on that resentment, then God can't direct our thinking. The resentment is directing our thinking. So apparently I'm going to have to do something about getting rid of resentments, empty out the display cases before God can begin to direct my thinking. And it's a very, very simple process. My book's getting ready to show me how to look at these resentments truthfully. It's going to show me how to get rid of those resentments. And the greatest thing of all, it's going to show me how to keep them from coming back in the future. And then God can begin to direct that part of my mind, Joe.
My book said that when the spiritual malady, the spiritual illness is overcome, it not only spiritual malady not only means my relationship with God, it means my own moral fiber. What kind of thinking do I have? A spiritual thinking, resentful thinking. If you're like me, you go to, when I first looked at page 65, I'm trying to do the inventory according to the big book, because I don't read the instructions, I don't even know they're in there. So I look at that first column and say, I'm resentful at Mr. Brown, write their name down. Change my mind and go to the second column and look at the causes why I'm upset with Mr. Brown. And then I go to the next column, what part of self is affected. I don't know anything about self and how it's affected, so I skip over that. And I go back to Mrs. Jones, and then back to the cause, change my mind again. Go to the third column, I don't know what part of self is affected by that because I don't know anything about self. And you don't do that very long, your little mind goes tilt.